Welcome to the Angular Plus Show, where app developers of all kinds share their insights and experiences. Let's get started.
So the children's story that I most often bring up in planning meetings at work is If You Give the Mouse a Cookie. Okay. Do you know this book?
I do not.
Classic.
Yeah. So like Brian, you're just recently into your parenting mission. Eventually you will get a copy of this book or one of its similarly themed sister or brother books.
I see that there's like 20 of them.
Yeah, there are quite a few, right? And so basically, for those of you unfamiliar with the story, it starts out with, if you give a mouse a cookie, he's going to ask for a glass of milk. But if he wants a glass of milk. And so it's like the cascading problem. And then you get to the very end and he just needs that cookie again. Right. And so I feel like this is how planning sessions often go. Cause I'll say, well, we need to fix this, the way this thing is filtering. And they'll say, yeah, but before we do that, we have to do this. And then somebody will say, yeah, but before we do that, we have to do this. And so it's the ever cycling, story of, you know, giving the mouse a cookie. Yeah, okay. Exactly. But I did have for today's episode, I decided that maybe I would use some AI to write a book for us, like a children's book for us.
Okay.
And it wrote this really great book. I think you'll figure out who our guest is after I read this book to you. It's not very long though, so I'm going to start.
We're reading the whole book today?
I'm going to read the whole book today, but it's really only like 6 pages.
Oh, okay.
So maybe like more if you like really spread out the words.
Font size? 6 pages? We talking like...
We're 11. 11. Yeah, like it's a nice... Like kids can read it, but there'll be a lot of drawings. So your kids are going to make you stop all the time so that they can point at all the things on the page. They'll be like, there's the one. And you'll be like, yes, I know. Let's just get this thing done. You got to go to bed. Anyways, okay. So here's how the book goes. There once was a man named Joe who loved Star Wars and coding so. He went to a conference called NGConf, the Angular conference, and he brought a clown with him for no reason why. He was coding. The clown loved Star Wars too, but only the Ewoks. That's just what he knew. Joe wasn't really into them, but they made it work anyway. They had fun. They talked about the movies and the characters and the lore, and they laughed and they joked and they had a great time. More than they ever thought they would at a conference about coding with a clown who loved Ewoks and a man who loved Star Wars. It was a match made in heaven. Or maybe it was just a coincidence. But either way, they had a great time and they made some new friends and they learned a lot about coding and Star Wars and life itself. And that's all that matters in the end, right?
Is this learning model based on a toddler? Do we clap
for this?
I think we need to clap. And then we introduce the man that this amazing book is about. Because this is going to be like the new book that all parents read.
What did you prompt this AI with? What's with the clown?
I think I said, and throw in a clown for no reason. It was kind of boring otherwise. Okay. So it was just like, here's a clown. And then I made the clown like Ewoks. But... That makes a lot of sense
because Ewoks are like the cutest of the creatures.
Like, yeah. Like as a young girl in the like 80s, the Ewoks is pretty much all I cared about. And that really upsets my adorable husband.
I feel like the Jawas were super cute.
Yeah, they're cute.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. No, they're not as cute as the Ewoks though. But now looking at the Ewoks, they're a little terrifying. Like if you really look at them, like they're like,
they're kind of like minions.
Yeah, like if you look back at like the Showbiz Pizza, like I don't know if you've seen that Showbiz Pizza documentary where they go through like the progression of Showbiz to Chuck E. Cheese, and like there was like this very scary mascot for a while that kind of just looked like a trash talking like New Jersey gutter rat.
I feel like we're getting off topic, Laura.
We're getting off topic.
Let's rein this sucker in.
We're gonna talk about Showbiz Pizza another day. Okay. But today, in case you can't tell from this book, our guest is the Star Wars loving, Ewok loving, clown accepting software engineer Joe Eames.
Conference organizing
Joe Eames.
I think you need to go update your LinkedIn title now, sir.
Yes, I do.
I would maybe omit the clown part, Joe.
You walk loving clown accepting. Maybe accepting of all.
Wouldn't that be a form of lying by omission then? Or you left out the clown?
Yeah.
They do say present your best self, right? Maybe I should That's consider right. that.
You should yeah. consider that, yeah.
The clown out. Like, I really like the end of it, where the book where they said that the only things that mattered in life are Star Wars and coding.
Right?
Really resonate with that.
I feel like that just kind of sums you up, right? So,
Joe, introduce yourself to the people.
Hey, I'm Joe Eames. I organize NG Conf along with Aaron Frost, and then a slew of many other people that are involved as well. Every year we have lots of other organizers that help out. And then I'm a software developer, been doing it since 96 as well. And since like 2012, I've done a lot of education. So
yeah,
spent a lot of time building courses and stuff. And I think I've published in quite a few places, but at least one place measures the count, Pluralsight measures the count, and it's just over 3 million people now have watched some part of at least one of my courses, at least 2 seconds of me.
That's pretty cool, though. I mean,
I've watched many seconds of Joe's courses, so.
And those courses
seconds over and over again.
And those are mostly focused on like Angular and
Angular and JavaScript. I'm probably 50-50 in the content that I published that's Angular or JavaScript.
Very cool.
Yeah.
What are we here to talk about today, Joe?
So we're here to talk about Enbridge. It's what I've been doing for the last like year, really through the scope of what's happened to Protractor, what's happening with it, with its end of life. The modern end-to-end testing tools. If you're not familiar with Protractor is an end-to-end testing tool. And Enbridge as a response to this whole entire scenario and situation that's going on to try to make things easier on people that have Protractor tests and want to get away from Protractor for the variety of reasons that you would have to get away from Protractor.
So Protractor was kind of the out of the box default with Angular, right? Both right. AngularJS and Angular, if I recall, yeah. right? So yeah. if I use the CLI and I create a new project, I get Protractor kind of out of the box, right?
Yeah.
It kind of stubs it out for me, wires it up, it's ready to go.
Yep.
And so that kind of was the default end-to-end test runner if you were writing Angular applications.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that you probably find that most, 99% of Angular applications until really the advent of Cypress were written with Protractor. And, Cypress, I'm sure, took some market share, but it was the first kind of really exciting product that was exciting enough to go away from the default.
Right.
Yeah.
There were certainly other options back then. You could, Protractor is just a layer built on top of Selenium, which is a layer built on top of WebDriver.
Right.
Right. So some people could have gone to just raw Selenium if they were using that in other projects and started doing Angular. Maybe they were just more familiar with it. But I think it was really easy, to use Protractor on top of Selenium. So I think that's probably pretty unlikely.
Right.
And it was such a great product, and there just wasn't too much else out there. So I think that's probably what most people have.
Well, it's hard to realize that Cypress wasn't even released until 2017. Like, it just feels like Cypress has always been around, but right. It's relatively new. And when it came out, it was like the browser, it only supported Chrome.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
So it made it really difficult for a lot of companies, especially companies that still got to support IE, to actually use it.
Right. Right. For sure.
Supporting for sure. IE.
Ugh. Yeah.
Yeah. Ugh. We had to support IE8 for a while. It was brutal.
But Protractor worked with IE, right? And all of those, right? Because it was built on top of WebDriver. And so it all just kind of worked.
It worked with pretty much every browser. So,
and Protractor was like pretty feature rich. It feels like, I mean, if I recall, like Protractor worked really well. Then it also, like historically, I think like they kind of stopped adding, like doing anything with Protractor. It feels like it just kind of sat idle for a long time. And then at this point, it's end of life, right?
Right. Yeah, it was funny during the AngularJS, they added these cool features for if you were building an AngularJS app, because you could, rather than locate elements, you know, locating elements is such a big part of end-to-end tests. It could locate elements, mm-hmm. not just by CSS selector or ID, right? But also by its Angular binding and a couple of other Angular JS specific features. And when Angular came out, there was always this like plan to do that, and they never did. I think the resources just fell off and
this wasn't there.
So, yeah, it just stayed. And so all the Angular specific features never got implemented in the new version. That was probably about that time was the time that Protractor went into more of a maintenance mode.
Yeah.
And now finally end of life.
Do you think it was ahead of its time though? I feel like the real push towards end-to-end testing did not pick up steam until like when we really saw a lot of Cypress work. Granted, I'm coming from consulting and that dysfunctional level I deal with clients. So my data set might be a bit off, but I feel like, you know, in Protractor's glory days, like end-to-end testing wasn't even on my radar as an AngularJS developer.
Good question.
Yeah, I think even unit testing for so long, like just getting any testing in, especially if you've worked in consultancies at all, like it's pretty standard that a lot of companies just didn't like. I think now like that I feel like we're starting to see a little bit of a change where people are like, oh, testing is important and we can like speed up processes with it. But I mean, like even a couple years ago, it was still like kind of a tough sell for people.
Jennifer, would your perception then be that people in general do use end-to-end testing more nowadays than they did maybe 5-6 years ago?
I would say like 5-6 years was kind of the number I was floating around in my head. Like, you know, of course, there are the companies that are on that cutting edge that are on top of doing things the right way. But I feel like, you know, this has been a more progressive conversation. I also feel like it's been a very developer-driven conversation where as we've had tools like Cypress, Playwright come to the forefront, it's empowering us to write in something in a native language instead of having to know Selenium, know Java, that kind of thing. And I really like, I know it was present. I just don't think it was something that people were pursuing actively. Like even that, well, okay. Granted, that's like decades in software time, 5-6 years ago, but
right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, interesting.
I feel like the companies that could technically afford to pay the developers to write the end-to-end test just paid QA engineers to test everything. And so there were like there were companies testing that way. And then smaller companies just not.
Yeah, because I mean that's still a fight, is why should we do end-to-end testing? Why can't we just have our manual testers do what they've always done?
I don't know if I have a strong feel one way or the other that the things have changed over time. I would guess though that because as newer tools come out, they're easier to use and therefore likely cheaper to implement, that we have seen an increase in adoption. Is that, you know, it's always about cost versus reward. No matter how great a practice is, if it costs too much, you just can't do it.
Yeah, definitely.
So I would guess, but Jennifer, that you're on the right track there, that we've probably seen a real increase in adoption of end-to-end. I think, though, one of the things that AngularJS did by bundling it in has probably helped move that forward faster.
Right? I agree. It was there. It worked. It was already set up.
Yeah, it at least made you feel anxious that you didn't have it. Like, I know I
should. Like, what do these do? Delete.
I can see it here. Or
you just
delete it.
You just want this E2E thing.
Right. And if you happen to be one of those people that read a lot of blog articles, you'd encounter a lot of judgment if you weren't testing, right?
Mm-hmm. That might be the case. And you feel shame.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, all that shame. Or if you go to the meetups and whatever, everybody talking about how you absolutely should be testing and you're bad if you don't.
You're like, I know. Oh, no.
Yeah. So. Protractor gone before we really knew how valuable it was.
Right. Yeah. It's an interesting thing that they end of life Protractor. I don't know that I would have predicted it, because as much as tools that are out now have significant improvements in their quality and developer experience and life, it was still, you know, Selenium is still a very widely used. It's a little bit like somebody saying, all right, that's the last version of jQuery. Like, well, I know there's better things out there now, but still a lot of people are still doing this. And
right.
Like 90% of the web is still like running jQuery somewhere. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. If there was some sort of like bug or issue that needed to be fixed in jQuery, it's not like they would be like, no, we're not going to do it. Like somebody would fix it. Somebody would patch it. Right.
Yeah, I love saying, you know, asking a question, what's Angular's biggest competition? jQuery, right?
Yeah, 100%.
100%.
What does end of life mean? So if I'm using Protractor today, and like, what does that mean, end of life? Does that mean that I'm not going to get any more feature updates, or they're not going to fix any bugs? Or what about like security vulnerabilities?
Yeah, same thing. There are no more security vulnerabilities either, which since you're not going to put your end-to-end tests in a public place, security definitely has a lower priority. It still has a fair amount of priority, and depending on your organization and your tolerance for security, they can have a really high priority even given so. But no more security updates, no more bug fixes, no more features. And that also means, you know, the web is a constantly evolving place. And really, the web runs on browsers. So as the browsers change and those sorts of things change, Protractor is no longer going to put that stuff in. And, you know, you could definitely start seeing some issues with stuff that websites that just don't no longer work in Protractor.
Yeah, because even if like you're writing JavaScript, like JavaScript is changing still too, you know, and so it's like you get a new feature in JavaScript and you think it's safe to use and it's not in browsers yet. And
Well, for me, at least, probably the most frustrating thing about any tool chain is, okay, one thing has changed and now I have to go and get the latest versions of all the other associated tools. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it just, the freaking thing doesn't work. And with Protractor, you know, I've been now neck deep in it, I guess, for the last year. And Chrome will release a new version of Chrome, but they won't release the corresponding updated version of the web driver for Chrome. And so then you have to tell Protractor to run in the older version of Chrome until that, you know, there's some time delay for like 2 weeks or something, you know. Just really frustrating things like that. So I think a really common scenario you're going to run into is, oh no, you know, you go and install it fresh, but now you're getting the new version of Selenium and Protractor doesn't have an update to work with the new version of Selenium or the new browser or whatever. And there's just no solutions anymore for it.
You don't also want to be like continuing to invest in this technology. Like if you're writing Protractor tests today, like that's probably not a good idea.
Overall, no. So Hero Devs is offering extended long-term support, never-ending support, they call it, for Protractor. So you can pay to get updated versions of Protractor that'll work as well. So that's potentially an option. But there now you're, Brian, you're talking about the other cost of using a software, which is the, I would call it the sort of human cost, right? Like dovetails into technology, but you use some really old piece of technology relative to the other pieces of technology, right? Like if you're using Java, the timelines are much longer, but in the in a front-end web, the timelines are super short, right? So that version of Protractor you're on seems like it's 80 years old. Nobody wants to work with it. It's tough to find updates and bug fixes and knowledge base and that sort of stuff. Now you have developers who, I mean, I remember I had a job where they had a product that was in some older technology and I literally made it a condition of employment. I will not work on that product. If you're going to hire me, I won't work on it. It's such a luxurious place of privilege to be as a developer, to be able to say that, you know, and we're one of the few jobs that probably ever happens.
Yeah.
I've done that with TFS. I was like, nope, I will not work if you make me use TFS.
Have a friend who is the small talk expert. Her job.
All right, we have to go on a side now. Everybody name off the technology that you would absolutely refuse the job unless you're starving, let's say. But outside of that, what technologies are just a deal breaker for you?
I don't want to do web forms again.
No more web forms.
I mean, I will, but I don't want to.
I mean, I could list off like a bazillion like dead things that I would
pick
touch
one.
Again.
Pick one.
Flash, ActionScript.
Okay, that one's pretty good too.
At the start of my career, I have a soft spot in my heart.
I know, but I wrote a lot of ActionScript and Flex and Flash stuff, but like, it's just like, it's buried, it's done. I wouldn't do it again.
I don't want to go dust that, I don't know if I want to dust those skills off. I'm sure I could remember how to do it, but yeah.
Question. I have a reverse Uno card of that question, a technology that I wouldn't touch in what circumstance would make me touch it. Have I told you guys about
would make me touch it?
What did you say, Jennifer? Have you told us about what?
The haunted strip club?
No.
No.
Okay. So
this is a great children's story also. Hold on.
Right. God bless it. But PHP, I don't want to do it. I don't want to do it. I don't know if it's because I started early in my career doing WordPress or Drupal or stuff like that. Just PHP, I'm sorry, not my jam. No hard feelings, but unless you have a project for a haunted strip club where something is broken with your FedEx integration because you were trying to mail ghost shrimp to a haunted strip club. In that case, I might learn how to fix your problem in PHP just so I can come hang out with your spooky aquarium at your haunted strip club. That is the one exception I will make for a technology I don't want to work with. This is a true story for my company, by the way. This is a lead that we got in, and I was like, field trip.
I'm doing that one.
Wow.
That is really specific.
That is really, that is really, so listen, usually it's a dollar amount.
Usually, I was just saying a lot of money.
With PHP apps out there, Jennifer's your person.
yep.
Okay.
Make it spooky, I'm on board.
How about you, Joe?
Which question?
Pick either one.
Mine or Jennifer's.
What's your favorite haunted strip club?
A technology I would absolutely not work with is Oracle. That's my top list technology.
But Oracle, that's a big, you mean like Oracle SQL?
Yeah, Oracle's database. Okay.
We had to learn that in college. That was the database that we worked with, in the terminal.
I had to use that at a job. Yeah.
Now, granted, this is a long time since, but somewhere around 2004 or so, I had to work with Oracle. And this is the key experience for me was when I told them, hey, can I take the disk? This is back when we actually worked in the office. For those of you, we're probably only 20% of our audience even remembers ever working in an office.
Pants?
We had to wear pants too. It was terrible.
And hard pants, not even soft pants, you guys.
Right. Yeah. Not even pajamas were not approved. I could never wear pajamas to work. It was rough. And I told the Oracle database admins, I was like, hey, I want to work on the project a little bit at home. And so a lot of times you'd take work home with you, and the internet existed and you could transfer stuff. But a lot of times you just manually move stuff, especially and installs happened on disks. You didn't download things to install them.
Couldn't you just SSH into your...
We didn't have that in that particular scenario to work on it. So I said, I want to install it at home. And I said, can you give me the disks so I can go install it at home? And I worked with a lot of databases, Microsoft SQL Server stuff. And literally the DBAs laughed out loud. My statement was so ignorant, it caused them to laugh. They said, no. You bring your machine in and we'll need it for a couple of days and we'll get Oracle installed on your machine. that's the installation process. And I was like, okay, that was the litmus event for me.
Okay. So what would it take for Joe Eames to do a project that involved Oracle and you were writing the back end?
Boy.
Crustaceans.
Yeah. It's something involving crustaceans. Oh, if it was for an aquarium, I would do it for an aquarium.
Okay. I love aquariums. Aquarium. Okay. Yeah.
Small aquarium or like a large aquarium, like Monterey Bay or.
Either. What types of penguins do they need to have?
Yeah, I mean, they probably need to have otters. If they have otters,
okay. That's fair. They are.
And of course, it would have to involve me being able to be on site and do stuff.
Right, exactly.
Probably.
You have to be on site because you have to bring your machine in to get installed on it. So I don't think you'd be able to work remotely.
If I could pair program with the otters, that would definitely do it for me.
Nice.
That would be interesting.
Found a new dream job, not going to lie.
Yeah, or put me with otters.
Okay, all right, back to protractor. Yeah. So protractor, end of life, like everything else. What are your options? I'm wondering, so I've already invested years of, I've got these tests, they're still running, or maybe they're a little flaky, and I want to move away from protractor. You mentioned that, so HeroDevs has kind of a never-ending support. So I could get support at least. That's good. Yeah. But I still have this, it's still technical debt, right? Yeah. Even if I put a Band-Aid on top of it, I'm still bleeding underneath, right? Yeah. So what do I do? What are my options? Do I just have to just throw it all away and move to, Playwright or Cypress or some other tool, or what are my options?
Yeah, so we can lay out the several, probably like four options here. Option number one is just leave it alone and hope it doesn't break. And that's not,
it's
not an ideal option. If you had a really old project that just had no budget, it wasn't changing, you weren't actively developing, that may not be the worst idea in the world. You still may say, well, and it's relative importance as well. What happens if that project, you couldn't release a bug because you couldn't run end-to-end tests, right? You really, that is the scenario of saying to yourself, what happens if my end-to-end tests one day just stop running? Would it be, how bad would it be? That's the question for that path. Second path, pay for never-ending support, has the nice thing that it's just a simple dollar outlay, right? Mm-hmm. You don't have to find resources. You don't have to devote their time. So that's never-ending support. Then the obvious ones of migrating. I think the two options that seem to be most likely would be Cypress or Playwright. Those are the kind of the two tools that generally in this area of the web people are choosing. There are other things that are out there, but those seem to be the ones that make most sense right now if you're moving to a new tool. So go through the migration process. The nice thing is end-to-end tests are not complex logic the way that your code is. So, on a cost per line basis, a migration from one end project to another is not nearly as going to be as high. If it costs you X number of dollars to migrate a 10,000 line project, it would cost you much less to migrate 10,000 lines of end-to-end tests, generally speaking, because the code is much simpler. You almost never see like if statements. You might see loops, but that's even that is kind of rare. It's mostly select this thing and check this thing, and the project itself shouldn't have to change at all in relationship to your end-to-end tool. That's not always true. A lot of times you build in special things for the end-to-end test. You might have to do some work on the project itself, but most likely you're doing most of your work in the thing. So migration path is the next obvious one. And then we built Enbridge as a third option to kind of try to bring the best of both worlds. Enbridge allows you to take your protractor tests and not modify them, but actually run them in Cypress, So it'd be a little bit like if I were to say, hey, you can take your Visual Basic code and start running it in JavaScript, for example, right? Like the tests look like they're Protractor, they reference all the Protractor APIs, but they're actually running on top of Cypress. So you can freely delete Protractor from it's not some like, hey, we're running Protractor and Cypress together or Selenium and Cypress together. You delete Protractor from your toolchain, and the tests are running on top of Cypress, and we'll have Playwright support sometime here in the future as well, so you can choose either product to run your tests in. The Playwright support is pretty far away, probably 6 months to a year, but right now you can run them in Cypress and do a pretty good job. So that's another option, is to do that. That still means there are some negatives to that as well, right? Like, now you have all these tests that are written in the Protractor style. And so if you have an issue with one of those tests, do you just make the change and still in the Protractor syntax? Or do you rewrite that whole test into Cypress? Mm-hmm. Are your developers going to be frustrated that you have this project running in Cypress, but the syntax is still Protractor syntax? You might need to learn two syntaxes. You can still write new tests in Cypress syntax and then have the old test running in Protractor. So I think it seems a little bit like that whole migration path from AngularJS to Angular, where you can leave the code that's in AngularJS, but it actually interops. It's a slightly bit better because in that case, you were still leaving AngularJS actually executing. So it and all that security vulnerability still existed in your app. And in this case, there's no Protractor, it's only Cypress. So it's just the syntax and how the syntax looks. And so a test is either got to be Protractor syntax or Cypress syntax. It can't be both. So if you have to do a bug fix, then you make that choice. Do I rewrite the whole test while I'm in here, or do I just make the bug fix and leave it as Protractor? So it could be a stopgap measure as well. But the nice thing is that you save all the money and now you're running on a modern tool and you get all the modern tooling. Like Cypress is time traveling. If you haven't experienced that, it's such a foundational experience. Like, whose mind wasn't blown the first time you saw time traveling on Cypress?
Give us like the 140 characters or less of what that is if somebody in the audience is not familiar.
Yeah, so if you haven't seen it, you should definitely go watch a video, but the short answer is, you got this end-to-end test that does like 10 things. It selects this element, clicks it, then selects this element, types this in, et cetera. The protractor or the Cypress time traveling allows you to see the state of your application at each point, and you could go back and forth, click mm-hmm. back and forth. You could even pause it in one of the things and actually work in the application itself. But if your test ever goes wrong, you can visually see why it's going wrong. If you're selecting the wrong element, it's so obvious. It actually highlights the element that you selected mm-hmm. at each step. It's so beautiful. It's truly a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you can totally see if your data filled and stuff. Like, did I actually
get it? It's kind of like seeing your first sunrise. Aww. You know?
Pretty close.
Yeah.
Maybe not. It's a spiritual close. Experience, I would say.
It is very helpful for debugging, though, right? I mean, because otherwise, before that, you're just like console logging and breakpoints. Yeah. You're just like you're just struggling to just figure out why is this test failing? Why is it not finding this element?
And especially if you're like debugging a race condition, like I had it one time where there was a weird page flash, and so it was. I don't know that console logging would have even caught it. I had to actually see it to be like, oh, it's because when it's looking for it, the data is literally not there. It shows up later.
Yeah.
So,
that's definitely one scenario where console logging is a real poor substitute for visually walking through.
Yeah, absolutely. So with Enbridge, I take my protractor tests and I just run them in Cypress.
Yeah. Yep. So you install Cypress, however you install it, you know. A lot of times people put the protractor slash Cypress in the same project, but okay. They don't have to be in the same actual project because the app just needs to be up and running itself. So the bigger organizations, the bigger projects probably have an entirely separate
repo.
App repo, yeah, for your end-to-end tests. But once you have your Cypress up and running, you install Enbridge. It's essentially an NPM module. It's not published to the public NPM repo, but it installs like an NPM module. And then you take your protractor tests and you can either physically, you know, if it's in the same project, you physically move them from one folder to another. If not, you're going to move them into the new Cypress project into its folders where it picks up, you know, you have to, and then tests have to be in some subfolder of some sort. You point it at it and say, here's where my tests are. So you put them there. You do have to go in and change the imports. So that's like the one change that you will have to make is you have to change your imports. Instead of importing from Protractor, you're going to import the same things from Enbridge. So when you import like element, the element function, which is like their main locator function, you'll import it from Enbridge instead of Protractor.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So really I take my Cypress tests, my Protractor tests, I get them, so they're running in Cypress. I make a couple of tweaks in my import statements and they just run.
Yeah. And that'll work for like somewhere between 90 and 99% of all of your code and all of your tests. There's certainly things.
Yeah. There's got to be some things that it can't do, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So there's some underlying fundamental incompatibilities between Protractor and Cypress. Thankfully, they really do line up really closely to each other. Mm-hmm. Playwright, the reason we chose Cypress before Playwright actually operates a little bit different foundationally. So it was a more straightforward path to Cypress from Protractor than it was to Playwright. But so there's a little bit more work under the hood for Playwright.
Is that because of like the asynchronicity of Playwright?
No, it's because of Playwright's injected page context. So the test, if you haven't seen this, it's so hard to describe code without looking at it, but the it function for a test, you actually receive a context object from Playwright, and that's an important thing. And Cypress and Protractor don't work that way, so they're far more analogous. So a common thing that's an incompatibility, for example, is async await. It's become somewhat popular they have a switch in Protractor. You can turn on this, set this configuration setting, and then you can use async await everywhere in your Protractor tests. Cypress uses a queuing system that is incompatible with async await. Right. So what's funny is the solution for it is you pretty much just delete all your async awaits in your Protractor tests as you migrate up, as you put them into the folder for Enbridge, and then they now work. This could be tricky. Now, one thing you can do is if you're ever doing anything in an async statement in a Protractor test that isn't directly Protractor, for example, let's say in the middle of a test, you call out to an API, and either set a value that you need in the next statement of the test or less commonly you request some value that's like, hey, how many people are in the database? And then I'm going to use that value to compare and say, are all these people listed on my page? And so it's, I need that number, right? Yeah. And you could do that very easily with async await, because you wait for the HTTP call to come back and then you do it. That sort of thing, you'd have to actually do some recoding through Enbridge and Cypress to make that. It's possible. You just have to do a little bit of recoding of that test. You could either rewrite it all the way in Cypress, or there's ways to do it in Enbridge.
Gotcha. Yeah, because in Cypress, you can just write that and you can say, hey, I want you to make this request and then psi.wait for this alias and then expect whatever these names to be on this page or this count or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But got it. So there's a couple of little narrow pieces maybe that I just don't out of the box just like instantly convert. But yeah, I mean, so you said 90%. That feels, that seems good.
Yeah. Yeah. So that, our goal is that you only have to touch one out of every 20 tests. And most likely what you'll actually have to do is maybe change. If you have, I mean, I've seen some pretty interesting projects that have a 4 levels of inheritance hierarchy in them in their end-to-end test suite. Can you imagine that? Yeah. So sometimes you might have to change some of your like utility functions.
Yeah.
That's a common one. But then you also encounter weird edge cases. For example, Protractor, I discovered this, ignores white space inside of an element, the trailing and leading white space in an element. It ignores it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So if you say grab the content of this element and compare it to a string, your string that you compare it to needs to not have the leading and trailing white space.
Yeah, trim it.
Protractor trims it for you. Now it's kind of interesting because in the, you know, as a web goes, the web doesn't honor that either. You don't see that in an element. Mm-hmm. You know, it would actually disappear. But Cypress honors that leading and trailing white space. Mm-hmm. So if for some reason you actually have that a lot in a product. And that's, I think that's kind of also odd to even occur. You're unlikely to have an element, you know, some data value you're sticking in that actually has leading and trailing white space. It'll happen, but I would say it's not common. Jennifer?
When you have back-end engineers writing the front-end code.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah.
No
so
shade, but a little shade.
So if you do encounter that, we actually have a, I wrote a Cypress, you can adjust, with Cypress, you can actually like adjust how it does its own job. So I wrote a Cypress add-in that will start ignoring. Cool. Yeah. Mm, nice. Yeah. And so, I mean, there's little things like that. And then we actually don't support 100% of the site or the Protractor API either. There's a few pieces that are like very odd. And this also inherently comes down to what Cypress supports and what Protractor supports, or Selenium really does. So Selenium supports all kinds of like key presses. It has this like key press library, and it has really weird ones that would be unusual, but Protractor doesn't. So the crazy thing, for example, is Protractor doesn't support the tab character, the tab key. So if you, in a test, go in and type and you want to hit the tab key,
tab
to go to Protractor, Protractor doesn't do it. You can move to the next thing, but the tab key itself isn't supported by Cypress.
By Protractor.
Cypress. It's not supported by Cypress. It's supported by Protractor Selenium, but it's not supported by
Glaring.
Cypress.
Like the special character, like bracket thingies or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting.
That's weird.
Yeah, tab is there's
isn't it's that how people use like keyboard navigation.
Like, well, yeah, but that's when you're
how is everybody else filling out forms? Do you click in every field, you monsters?
Well, when you're writing an end-to-end test, you probably say grab the username box, type into it. Now grab the next box and type into it.
It could be just an opinionated piece of Cypress in that, I mean. Maybe you could argue that like doing that is going to lead to flaky tests, like relying on the tabbing between fields. And you really should be getting the elements by like a data sci or data test attribute or something like that.
Right. Now that Cypress team, I was just looking at this and I'm pulling it back up. They were working on support for tab, and there's an add-in for Cypress called something like Real Events that adds in support for not only tabs, but there's other like event firings that Cypress, weird kind of low level stuff that Cypress doesn't support. But and then there's like this weird list of like keys, like print screen. And I can't even think of all of the, there's this huge list of keys that Selenium supports. And so by default, so therefore Protractor does, and Cypress has a supports a small subset of those.
Huh. It feels to me though, like Joe, like that these, even these, what we're talking about now, like I would imagine not many people are using these in Protractor tests anyways, right?
Right.
I would think that if I'm using Protractor today and I want to migrate to Cypress and I want to reach for something like Enbridge, I can imagine that maybe there's like some narrow instances where maybe I'm using some of these features. But I would suspect that, does that line up with kind of your experience?
Yeah. Yeah. So as we look at the beta clients that are testing with us and what APIs they actually utilize, we, you know, there's like that kind of like 80-20 rule. So the API of Selenium, so Protractor is built on top of Selenium. You can actually also import things from Selenium and do all kinds of stuff. That API's surface is very huge, but 90%+ of the projects out there are using a small subset, 10-20% of it for their work, right? And then there's funny things like in Protractor, you do all this stuff like, hey, wait for this element to be clickable so that then I can click it, right? And Cypress inherently supports it. So in Protractor, when we implemented that API, we just said, ignore it, you know, don't do anything because Cypress just doesn't. Yeah, exactly. We know how that.
Yeah.
So lots of funny, interesting things as you compare the way that the two rules to things work, right? Like Cypress doesn't support any of the function keys. You can't type a function key in when you're in a text box, as an example. You know, so there's, but the, what's nice is Cypress also has a huge API, but it doesn't matter that we support the whole Cypress API. We just have to support the stuff that Protractor does. We have to support it in Cypress, right?
Can I mix? So if I have these Protractor tests in my Cypress directory, can I mix the two? Like, can I mix the code if I wanted to? I'm not saying maybe I should, but can I write Cypress? File. Not in the same file. So I can't do like a sci.get or sci.wait right next to the Protractor, like, or the Enbridge supported code. Right. I can't do that.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. But I can write a new spec file and just use Cypress.
Exactly.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense.
Gotcha. Yeah, and the easiest way to configure it is to actually have them in different like subdirectories. So have your Cypress syntax tests in one subdirectory and Protractor in another, because we do a lot of TypeScript stuff for Visual Studio Code support. So it's easier to do that by directory. But you could even put them theoretically in the same directory. You just have to be in separate files. And mostly it's about that import, the imports. You know, you're going to import certain things that would screw up Cypress.
Yeah.
So when somebody's trying to decide which migration path they should take, what kind of advice would you have for them?
Fantastic question. If you got to look at criticality of the product matters, resource investment in the product matters, and the human resource factors matter a ton. So you got to ask yourself, what happens if my end-to-end tests are unreliable for a while? And that actually surprisingly means that making a migration, you would think, well, the more critical it is, the more important it is to migrate. But actually, the migration process is a huge problem because you're going to have some time period where you have your entire test suite running in Protractor and portions of it running in Cypress or Playwright. And now how do you manage that in your CI just became way more complex now. You have to run end-to-end tests in two different things and report failures from two different products. And let's say that you've migrated one test over to Cypress from Protractor, and now you have some failure somewhere in the system. Where is that at? Which test suite are you going to use? Did you introduce a bug in the new Cypress test that you just rewrote? You have to manage that. The slow migration actually has some real big problems with it, which is actually why if you're going to do a migration, Enbridge is actually a beautiful way to do it, because now you instantly have everything. And when I say instantly, you know, for a small project, it's maybe going to take you a day. For incredibly huge, if you have 10,000 end-to-end tests, it could take you a couple of weeks to get up and running on Enbridge. But in a short time frame, you have everything running in Cypress, and now you can migrate test by test from Protractor to Cypress, but still only be running one tool, still don't have to worry about one tool chain, all that sort of stuff. So
one step in the pipeline.
Yeah.
That makes
resource
sense.
Resource investment is going to be an important question. If you have a low resource investment, you're either going to stick with Protractor and just let it go away. You're going to have to use Enbridge because it's the lowest cost, but migration is probably not realistic if you have a low amount of resources to devote to your end-to-end tests. Priority in the moment, right? Like maybe you're somewhat resource constrained. You do have plenty of money. You're actively spending a lot of money on the project, but it's so important right now to add features that fixing this technical debt is super low important for the next 6-12 months. So again, that's where you stick around with Protractor and make everybody suffer, pay for never ending support, or use Enbridge, but the migration is not going to be a good path. But if you have high resource availability, a migration is going to be nice. I still think it's hard to justify a scenario where Enbridge doesn't make sense, because that migration, unless you're going to migrate Playwright right now, if you're going to migrate to Playwright, Enbridge won't help you.
Yeah.
But otherwise, it's so much nicer to just have everything running instantly in Cypress, but then you now migrate the syntax.
That's nice. Like we did that, like sort of a lower level, like we were sort of rewriting how we were approaching our unit tests, right? And moving more towards like the Cypher setup. And since that's just a different setup, you can start to move tests out of the test bed setup and into this other setup. And so it's nice when you can kind of create like this is the brand new side of things. And then this is the old, you know, like having the two separate directories, the subdirectories, like you were talking about, so that you can put new tests in Cypress with Enbridge and keep hanging on to those old ones. I would say there's also like, maybe take a look at your tests. Are they actually valuable? When a lot of people start writing tests, they're not known for writing super valuable tests. So that could be another consideration.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point, because you might find that it's not a big deal to just drop all the NN tests other than maybe the descriptions of them and then start rewriting from scratch. And that's actually such a nice thing to be able to drop how they were implemented, not really worry, just say, well, we need to check that we could do this or this or this if you have good test names. And unfortunately, like unit tests tend to describe the name of the test often describes enough that you can implement the entire test from the name. NN tests oftentimes are not this way, because it's not best practice to write a large number of small, tight, one function end-to-end tests. It's better practice to write an end-to-end test that does 20 things. So you might have an end-to-end test that just says the homepage works, and it tests 15 things, 20 things, right?
Right. Yeah. Login page works. Login successful.
Yeah.
Yeah. I find to your point of like unit tests, if you write like a good like test or it statement, like Copilot will just write the whole test for me, and like it's just like I just tab and I'm like, yeah, that's pretty darn close. I fix it up, don't get me wrong, and like go through it.
I change like, some words around so I don't get accused of plagiarism. But
no, it's not plagiarism. It's
Copilot. No. I mean, like, you know, like if you turned in a paper where you just copied the dictionary, that you'd have to.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it doesn't always get it perfect, right? Too. Like, yeah. It's not like. But it's pretty close. If you write a good like description block, it'll be like, oh, okay, yeah, I know what you're trying to test here. And so it's pretty good. So whereas I think with Cypress test, to your point, like unless you like put a comment above it and like almost like prompt engineering the AI, and you're like, I want to click on this, then click on this, then click on this, expect this, hit the login form, and it should route to this page. And then at that point, you're already writing like most of the test anyways. Yeah. And so, I think you're right about like the complexity between the two for sure.
And what would happen if you didn't have your end-to-end tests in place for a little while? Would that be a huge deal? That's a great point, question too. To ask. You might still be like, oh, we'd still release if our end-to-end test suite wasn't working today. We would still release. Are your tests so flaky? People like... I don't know if any of you have lived in this situation. I've lived in this situation, right? The end-to-end tests fail and nobody cares because they always fail. Yeah.
They just skip them.
Just hit the merge button.
Yeah, you hit merge, you hit deploy anyway. You're more like, no more than 10% of the tests failed. So I feel comfortable to hit deploy.
I think that's like
that one fails all the time.
Or that always fails. Like that test super flaky or... Yeah.
And I'm but tired
then you have like an unreliable test suite, and then people are just pushing to prod anyways, or pushing to staging or whatever.
Yeah, it's such. It seems like such a bad situation, but I think that so many organizations live there for specifically NN tests.
Yeah,
I know that there's.
It's hard to get them right, you know. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. So
yeah, and the older the technology is, the worse that was, right? Mm-hmm. It's you see that less and less with more modern tools, but with Selenium-based tests and things like that, back before they supported async await, especially, you know, then you'd just be like, I'm tired of adding in five more seconds of waiting. So mm-hmm. just not going to do it anymore. And if it fails, I mean, I remember the time when we had add-ons that would just, you know, the test suite fails, it runs it again and runs it a certain number of times. And it looks, you have a threshold of number of failures out of, correct. You know, 10 mm-hmm. that actually then reports to you, right? Like that's how bad the situation was.
Yeah. Run it three times. And if it, as long as it passes once, like, right. Okay, we're good.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
So I have a question about Enbridge specifically. Are you guys using this? Is this in like in production? Like where are you guys at with this project and with this product?
We're in beta. The main reason we're in beta is because none of the documentation exists to really allow somebody to use it on their own. So okay. We kind of have to handhold them through the process. We have a handful of beta clients that are in the process in various stages of utilizing Enbridge. So it's in a great place. It's very stable and it runs pretty well. And for then the moderate test suite, like if you're 500 to 1,000 tests, you know, we're in a really sweet spot. If you're over 1,000 tests, it could be a lot, you know, more work. It's still obviously very valuable, but it could be a mm-hmm. lot more work. And every time we get a new beta client, we find a new piece of the API that we want to support and add support for.
So if I'm like a developer and I'm listening to this podcast, I'm like, hey, I think this could be viable, but I need to like prototype it before presenting and getting buy-in from the business. How would somebody go about doing that?
Well, that's basically our onboarding process anyway. So you reach out like enbridge.dev or is the URL that redirects you over to.
It says you're still in alpha, by the way.
Does it really?
Yeah.
If only yeah, you knew, I, like some web and like some web developers that could change that for you.
Yeah, I need to update that. It's a pretty gray line between alpha and beta, that's for sure. But you contact us, and then it'll be me along with some other people that'll reach out to you, and then we'll schedule a quick. Usually, we schedule a quick demo because people actually want to see like. Mm-hmm. me using it on my computer and show you exactly your process. But then we actually sit down with you for a short while, help you implement it there, like on a local dev machine. Usually, unless there's security issues, I'll just actually pair with you, get on a Zoom call or something, pair with you for like an hour. We'll get it up and running and get maybe one or two tests up and going. And then you have a really good estimate as far as like, how much are we utilizing APIs that Enbridge doesn't support? That Cypress mm-hmm. doesn't support. So therefore, how much work is it to convert our entire test suite? Now you have, basically, you could do the math and say, all right, this is the entire amount of work it's going to take to get us onto Enbridge. And now you can go forward and go back to management and say, hey, we can go move forward and get on Cypress. Now, of course, this doesn't account for your CI/CD, you know, your poor DevOps engineers that have to install a new tool into the tool chain, right? Mm-hmm. Which could be a one-day project and that, or it could be a four-month project. Depending mm-hmm. on the complexity and size, right? But
and I feel like most DevOps teams already have a backlog longer yeah. than their arm. So buy your DevOps team cookies.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So how much work it takes to incorporate Cypress? But that was something you're going to want to do eventually anyway, right? If you're going to leave Enbridge, is irrespective of that. I need Cypress in my tool chain. It's going to take that work. But now you have a good estimate for how much work it's going to take to get every test working on Enbridge. You can get buy off for it and then move forward.
Yeah, it sounds like a great sort of strategy to, you know, alleviate it, especially if your organization is really relying on those end-to-end tests for peace of mind that the yeah. code is releasable, not having to spin up two separate steps in the CI/CD pipeline. Like you can still have some of your devs technically writing Protractor if that's what they want to do. You can have there will probably be some holdouts, right, that want to just keep writing their Protractor tests, and then uh-huh. But then you can start moving your dev teams towards Cypress or eventually Playwright.
Yeah. And I think in general, you know, other than if you've written a lot of utilities already, you just mm-hmm. have this huge utility library, but the newer tools are really easy to learn. Mm-hmm. You know, Cypress is super easy to learn. Yeah, it does have its own API. Playwright is nice because it doesn't really have as nearly as much of an API as Cypress does, mm-hmm. but Cypress is super easy to learn. It's not the same thing as really, it's not nearly the same effort as going from, say, AngularJS to Angular, right?
Yeah.
Migrating your framework. Your NN tool is more straightforward. Certainly the API usage is a lot more straightforward. It doesn't take much. So you're not going to find a place where you're going to have people that are like, I can't bother to learn Cypress. I'm going to keep coding in Protractor. Because truly, yeah. it's like, you know, an hour into coding Cypress and you're probably 90% effective.
Right? Well, and I feel like too, like if you're a company and you're looking to attract talent, I'm not necessarily interested. I mean, like we were joking around about what technology will you never work in again, but you know, it feels that way too. Like, I don't want to spend my time learning Protractor since mm-hmm. it's dead, you know, like it's, right. you know, there's no point in me learning it. And so if you can say, well, we do have some Protractor tests that will need to be supported, but we're writing all our new tests in Cypress, it feels like a much more attractive employment situation for people as well.
Yeah, for both acquisition and for retention, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Generally, people quit their managers, not their jobs.
Sure.
And if you've eliminated that, then the technology is probably the second most important thing, you know, to a developer. Mm-hmm. It's funny how, as developers, technology matters so much to us. It mm-hmm. super does. It can matter more than pay. In fact, the surveys that I've seen show that technology choices matter more than pay.
More than pay. I think pay is like 3 or 4 yeah. down the list. Mm-hmm. It's like team, technology, you know, opportunities to grow, pay yeah. or something like yeah. that. But yeah. Mm-hmm. So yeah, really good point there.
Yeah. And another thing to keep in mind as well is, you know, with our partnership through Hero Devs, it also means that if you don't have the resources to do the work of the implementation, we can actually do the whole implementation for you as well. Get money, but not people time. We can actually do the implementation.
Do the migration.
Yeah.
In those migration yeah. scenarios, Joe, do you bring in Enbridge and then rewrite everything to Cypress? Or is it just kind of based on what the client's looking for?
Yeah. So if you have a big enough project that even your Enbridge implementation is going to take a while, we can just do that for you. If you're going to Cypress for sure, we'll use Enbridge as an interim product, unless you have a small enough test suite that the overhead of just
knock them out in a day yeah. or a couple of days or something.
Yeah. 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 Probably if it's like going to be like less than maybe even a couple of weeks, it's not worth bringing Enbridge in anyway. But mm-hmm. otherwise, yeah, it makes tons of sense. Unless if you're going to Playwright, then Enbridge isn't an option at the current time.
Yeah. So it seems like Enbridge really serves kind of a sweet spot of somewhere between like, I don't know, 25 to a couple hundred tests or something like this.
Is I would say 1,000. Like. 1,000 yep. is my internal cutoff point. Over 1,000, it still serves it really, really great, but now there's definitely more work involved. But by that time, you're 1,000, like if you're at 10,000 NN tests, the project size is probably huge, unless you're doing a really anti-pattern with your NN tests and writing tests.
Yeah, I'm like, you could be writing NN yeah. tests like unit tests, and then you're right. going to have a lot of tests.
Right. Yeah, so if you... You know, a good rule of thumb is one end-to-end test per 10 unit tests is a general mm-hmm. thing. So if you're in that scenario, you feel like, hey, we got 80% test coverage of our unit tests and we have 10% as many end-to-end tests, then you're probably sitting in that center of the bell curve for those things. And so anything over 1,000, it's probably a big, you know, effort. Even bringing on Enbridge is going to take a month or so, but you're also probably looking at 6 to 12 months if you want to just migrate everything anyway. So mm-hmm. a month versus 12 months of work makes tons of, yeah. And everything we're seeing is that Enbridge reduces the cost by 90%. And when your company wants to spend money on stuff and you say you can spend money on features or you can spend money right. on fixing a piece of technical debt that doesn't even matter doesn't even actually exist in the product, it's hard to sell mm-hmm. that. So yeah. hard to sell that. And that's, again, why Enbridge was such an important project to me to put together, was because I lived in that scenario where I hate my tests, my end-to-end tests. They are mm-hmm. a drain on my life, they're sucking my will to live, right?
Your happiness.
Mm-hmm. But they're not a big enough priority for anybody to fix.
Yeah.
So they just sit.
And you can do, like, if you're moved to a more modern tooling like Cypress or eventually Playwright or whatever, you can develop faster too. Like, yeah, it's easier to write those tests. So you can get feature development out faster if you're using modern tooling. And then that feature work is still well protected. And so, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure. For sure. Yeah. Like, if you've ever been in the experience of doing the test driving through end to end tests, right? Right. An end to end test first, next to everyone. That's pretty wild and crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Wait, say that again?
To write your end-to-end test first. Don't write, not your unit test. You write your end-to-end test first, then you write your unit tests, and then you write your code.
Uber TDD.
That seems, Uber TDD. That seems counterproductive to me. I'm going to go ahead and be spicy now, with that.
It only
ridiculous.
It really works in a fairly limited number of scenarios, but it actually can work relatively effectively.
I think TDD only works in, like, really, if you have like something that you are well understand, you know, what your outcomes are, yep, and
BOM the requirements. That you're,
was that you, so you have all the requirements,
BOM requirements.
Yeah.
And I think you also, TDD works in very limited scopes, in my opinion, like only when you know, like, the requirements and what you're trying to accomplish, and you want to write the tests first because you know that writing the code is going to be really hard. But I think a lot of times, and this is just me being spicy, I think a lot of times you just write the code first and then you write the test afterwards. And I know, like, people like on the TDD train are like, no. And I'm like, I just don't see it.
All right. So now you got to let me counterpoint and get on my soapbox.
Let's do it. Let's go.
I am on the TDD train so hard. Like,
oh yeah.
Driving the train.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I'm like right behind.
Oh my god,
he
just got his conductor hat out.
Wait. Let's use, if we're gonna get going on this, let's use like a solid example. Like, I'm writing an Angular component of some kind. Give me like an example, and then tell me how like writing the unit tests first would be beneficial.
Okay. Yeah. Let's go. You just described my weekend. What I was doing on the plane back and forth to New York.
Leisure activity.
Right? Okay. All right. I love it.
So
is this the same weekend when you skip saying hi in Kansas City?
No,
busted. Not that weekend.
Yes, I am busted for that one. Yep. You actually in Kansas City, Jennifer?
Yes. I would have taken you to all the good restaurants.
I did miss out. Mm-hmm. I did miss out.
And she makes really good paella.
Huge apology for that. I actually thought you, for some reason, I thought you were like a couple hours outside of Kansas City. I don't know why I thought that. And all right, anyway. I'm on the plane. I'm coding.
Roast you for that.
I do have a personal, a passion project I do for fun. It's related to a game. And fortunately, it's really code heavy, and I TDD 100% of it. I feel so much more comfortable TDD. It's really complex code. So what it does is it actually simulates really complex dice rolls in a game that I play.
I'm starting to see, but that's what I said. It's got to be really complex code. And you know the outcome ahead of time.
Yes, I know the desired outcome ahead of time. Right. So I can say, hey, this should produce this result.
Right.
And I write the test and then I write the code. So okay. Here's on the opposite side, Angular. I believe very strongly in not testing your templates, except for very limited cases. Mm. And I feel like you should. So I have this spicy video on the ng-conf YouTube channel called "You're Probably Writing Your Unit Test Wrong," and the comments are hilarious because it was a very visceral reaction from two groups of they hated what I said and they loved what I said. And the whole thing was, I pointed out that in Angular, if you generate a new test, it puts the test bed in the test automatically.
Yeah.
And you only need the test bed. Actually, is a really big, heavy thing. It takes time to construct it, initialize it.
No,
you only need it for a few very limited things. It supports the backend mocking, because you're mocking your API for your HTTP requests, and it supports the template being tested in a unit test. That's the only two things you actually need it for.
Like a pile.
So, So for most, like, say, services, it's completely unnecessary to have it.
Now,
this is also my problem with the new inject function. The inject function, you also would probably need, I believe you need the test bed in order to use
You have to test use, test. Well, so, you don't really need the full test bed because you're not doing like a compile, but you have to write like testbed.run in injection context. So that way it knows how to like inject the, like the injector and, or get the reference to the injector. Right.
Right.
But yeah.
So I, in there, show, hey, you don't need to, these are just plain JavaScript objects. If you're just testing the code of your component. Yeah. If you're just testing the methods, the code of your component, just testing the code of your service, you don't need the test bed, which is this overhead. You only need it for the templates. Now, if you write a test that you test the templates, I consider that to be a code smell, where a code smell means I might have a reason to do it. A code smell isn't 100% wrong. It's just, I should always look when I'm doing it and really consider, should I be doing this? And if the answer is yes, then I do it. So that's my definition of a code smell. So given that definition, using the test, but testing your template is a code smell because you should only test your template when there's something complex enough that it needs to be tested. For example, setting up a click binding to call a function on a click event, that doesn't need to be tested. How difficult is that to get wrong? It's very difficult to get wrong. It's very difficult to break it. Have like even a junior level developer come in and just put the wrong thing in and suddenly this button isn't hooked up. It's difficult. Are you full of junior developers? Cool, test them then. But if your team is mostly senior developers and you do have code reviews and stuff and it's pretty obvious.
Some of that stuff would just get caught by the TypeScript compiler or by the Angular compiler.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, like if you're just like testing Angular interop, like I
don't exactly, think you need to do that. So like, don't test the framework. Right. So don't worry about that stuff. And then if you have really complex logic inside of like an NGIF or something like that, you probably should move that into the component anyway. So my point is there's a limited scenario. It's not that there's zero. It's just limit your scenarios where you're testing your templates. In that case, you don't need it. So going back to your point, Brian, you were saying like if it's simple code, the TDD is overhead. I 100% agree with that. Like I don't test my templates, anything like that. And if its component is just like got two lines of code in this method that takes the click event and dispatches it off. Form.
And yeah. You click a button and
it's low value testing.
So I have my counterpoint to that is that so Sandy Barr gave a talk in Omaha at Konecaha about unit testing for accessibility.
At where?
Templates. Konecaha, it's a small conference Konecaha. In Omaha. Yeah.
Jennifer was there.
I was there.
That's a really it Konecaha, just fits yeah. with Omaha. Yeah.
It was a good conference name. Good conference. But yeah, she did this whole talk on unit testing from accessibility. So if you use the Angular testing library, you can actually get template elements by role, and you can essentially get some of your accessibility testing out of the way. Mm-hmm. And so that's an approach I like to take So things that are isolated to a single component, I will unit test that way. And then anything that bridges between components, I write end-to-end tests for.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. That's Kenzie Dodd's
whole thing, right? Is like,
yeah, test like it, I like, totally agree with like not, I don't need to like.
Get by role, get by, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like that'd be like, so from that perspective, and honestly, if I have a lot of logic happening in my component, I typically pull that onto a service anyway. So.
Yeah. Okay, so two sides of that. One, number one, Brian, do you know who taught Kent C. Dodds how to unit test?
Yes.
I mean, I think maybe somebody who really likes clowns did.
Kent C. Dodds was an intern at a company of mine. Nice. And I actually taught him how to write unit tests.
Yeah. Nice. So you're the OG clown.
No. Kent's a super smart guy. I just happen to be.
But his testing library is fantastic. And I think it takes a lot of that approach, right?
Maybe his Obi-Wan or something. Like, is there some
Joe is Yoda status here, I feel. Yoda. Like, Luke's a badass, but
he's not that old. He's
old and hairy ears. Old and hairy ears. I can identify with that aspect of Yoda. Old and hairy ears.
You're wearing a green shirt today, so yeah.
But back to your point, Laura, that's very interesting. I've never actually considered that, but aren't there also like some add-ins that just constantly look at your code and say, hey, you've got these accessibility issues as well. Yeah. So are those... Is that more or less, is using one of those tools, is that more or less better or facilitated?
It's a layer on top. Like, so at what we're trying to get, it's not fully implemented at Cisco yet, but we have all of the like linting rules in place. I think that if you can do nothing else for accessibility, get the linting rules in place. And Sandy actually wrote, she added a couple new ones to the Angular linter. But yeah, if you can get the linting rules, that's going to take care of a lot of your problems. But then having the unit testing is just sort of like double checks that people don't come in and make some dumb change that breaks accessibility. And but yeah, I'm hoping she will write more about it, because I think it's really, interesting. I'm really excited about it. It makes a lot more sense to me than throwing a test ID on an element, grabbing it and clicking it, because then we're doing like, you're essentially like, did the Angular work? So, but if you can kind of like make some other reason for it on top of it, then yeah, it makes sense. But,
This is one of my favorite subjects in the world, Brandon. I've got to circle back to one more thing about the whole overuse of TDD. Mm-hmm. I had an experience where I wrote back in like 2010, wrote the first HTML viewer for Pluralsight's video player, right?
Okay.
And we had no idea what it was going to look like at all. And so test driving it was actually a really bad idea, because we had no concept what the code was going to. So what we actually did was we wrote a fairly functional prototype of it.
Yeah.
We threw it away. They were 100% TDD, 100% pairing place. We threw it away and then wrote it with TDD.
Right.
So there's another thing that, like, if the code is so easy, it's probably TDD is fairly low value. But also, if the code is completely unknown, it's also not appropriate yet. You have to know that, okay, I know I can code this. I just want to make sure I'm coding it correctly. But there's another thing about TDD versus test after that I think is important, which is TDD forces you to write your codes in certain shapes. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a very high correlation between the shape of code and quality. Mm-hmm. And so testing after, sometimes you go in there and you're like, it's not the shape I would have made it if I had written the test beforehand.
Right.
So therefore, I'm not going to rewrite it. I'll just write a less effective test and potentially leave yourself with less. Like, it's not the only, you can obviously write bad code that's testable, but I think there's a high correlation between testable, especially
I agree
about testing up front.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Well, and I find that, like, I've tried to go in and put in some after the fact unit tests on some of those like really long, like 1,000-line components. And even just passing in enough state to instantiate the test is difficult, let alone figuring out, like, is it in the right state to test this function to do? Like, in that case, literally all you can do is test the methods directly. So,
yeah. But I think, like, to your point, Joe, like in that instance, like, I think that's like a good opportunity. If you prototype it and then test it and then build it, right? Like, that's a great example. And I think to your point of the same thing, if I write some bad code and I test it and I realize it's bad, like, that's a great opportunity for me to go to iterate on my code and like clean it up and like kind of, you know, massage it a little bit. So anytime you're writing tests, though, I think it's always a good thing, because it forces you into those things, right? Yeah. Sometimes, like, forces his developers to be like, oh, well, I did this wrong because I can't test it, or my test is really janky because I had to like figure this hacky thing out. And so kind of almost forces you to write better code if you're writing tests.
Well, I hope that the audience was interested in talking about, or listening to us talk about, unit testing, because we really went off on a tangent. It was the worst thing in the world to do was to start talking about TDD around me.
Sorry.
Well, okay, so Joe,
I feel like I did that.
What if I wanted to talk to you more about TDD?
Oh my gosh.
How can I do that?
You just literally ping me on Twitter or whatever, and that's it. And I'm just
comment on Joe's NG comment.
My wife will miss, I'll miss my date with my wife, just so we can sit and talk about it. Right. Come to NGConf. That would be awesome.
Yeah, when's this NGConf? This episode is meant to run, I believe, the week before NGConf. Okay. So if you're listening, and you like to like plan spur the moment, go get your ticket. Get your late bird ticket. Get your hop on one of those flights where they're like, I guess we have a few seats left, right? But yeah, so NGConf is June, let's see, the 12th and the 13th, 12th. or the 12th and the 13th are the workshop days.
Yeah.
And then the 14th and the 15th are the days for the general conference. And I believe there's that evening track as well on Tuesday, mm-hmm. correct?
Yeah. Don't forget Tuesday night.
So if you're coming for the conference on Wednesday and Thursday, make sure that you arrive Tuesday afternoon so you can hit the Tuesday evening bonus tracks. But yeah, Joe will be there and he will be cornered, absolutely mobbed by people wanting to talk to him about either Star Wars or TDD. Both are options.
Or clowns. Yes.
Dress like a clown that likes Ewoks to talk to Joe about TDD. That's hell who know that's what you're there for.
Oh my gosh, I'm just imagining an Ewok in a clown costume.
Nice. The reveal
red
on
nose,
that would be magical.
Big
like
they shoes.
Take off the nose and you're like, oh, you're an Ewok, buddy. You're an Ewok. And
it's actually that'd be like fun to dress Ewoks. Your kid up like that. You could dress your kid up like an Ewok clown.
Ewok clown. Like,
really throw people off.
Jennifer, what are your kids' Halloween costumes?
What's Mira going to be for Halloween?
Yeah.
I am in survive sleep training mode right now.
Live is the answer.
No thought.
Before the podcast, we were just talking about sleeping. Yeah. Like,
nice.
No, I like not even close. And like, we've got her first international trip coming up in like 2 weeks. So that'll be her fourth conference.
Well,
so what I heard just, is that she's being dressed as an Ewok clown.
Let me put in a bid for something more for an Ewok, just a general Ewok. Mm-hmm. I'm going to put in a bid for that. A little bit easier than the Ewok clown. So mm-hmm. Pixar, you know.
Yeah. We'll see. I don't know. Maybe I'll be like, screw you guys, and she'll be a Jawa.
Nice. I want baby Grogu though, because if she is dressed like baby Grogu, I won't be able to like resist.
Most common costume for sure.
Oh my God. Although I'm not a huge Grogu fan. Like oh my God, all the like the Star Wars stuff happening right now hurts my soul. But I did see an epic shirt at Costco the other day where it was Grogu, but with Mahomes' haircut. Mahomes is our quarterback with a very distinct, it was pretty cute.
I don't know. Grogu and the little robot where he could say yes and no was like the best thing I've ever seen on television. So,
did you like Andor, Jennifer?
We have not watched a lot of the Star Wars ripoff stuff. And like, I am the person who like, since I was like 12 or 13, has read like every offshoot book series. So, I'm a little hipster about my Star Wars fandom.
I'm tolerating the live action stuff. I love the cartoon stuff.
Nice.
So like Bad Batch and Clone Wars and Rebels. I've really enjoyed those. But Andor is some of the best TV that's been made.
I've heard that.
Regardless of Star Wars, it's some of the best TV that's been made.
This episode really has been in every single rabbit hole.
Oh yeah. But what like, no, I was Jennifer? Like, I grew up reading like Rogue Squadron and the Mandalorian armor and like that whole thread of Boba Fett's journey. And so, yeah.
Did you read the Republic Commando series, Jennifer? Triple Zero and all of those with the ARC troopers and the Nulls. And did you read that series by, what was her name? Not Elaine Cunningham. I can't remember her name. I mean, outside of the the original Thrawn series, this is definitely, in my opinion, the best series, Star Wars novel series, and an entirely different ethos and mythos around Mandalore and so the current version is really poor in comparison to what they had in those books. So
interesting.
No, yeah, if you haven't read that series, you should read that series. It ends with like a Imperial Commando or something, but it's about the commandos, the clone commandos. So and they talk about the tiers, right? There's the regular troops, and there's the ARCs, and then there's the Nulls, and the commandos were kind of in the middle, and it's this particular group of them, and one of them falls in love with a Jedi and they have a baby, and it's
of course they do. Of course they do.
Great series, absolutely. After the original Thrawn series, and actually I like the new Thrawn series as well. Must read Star Wars. You know, the new Jedi Order series was also fantastic, but especially the Yuuzhan Vong thread. Did you read that whole thing? Oh, no, those are the ones that I read. Of course, best book ever was Tales of the Bounty Hunters. That was the best Star Wars novel ever. Oh,
yep.
So good. So good.
Nice. All right. Well, I eventually have to go back to work today. So if you want to pick up this conversation with Joe, please join us at NG Conf in Salt Lake City. We'll all be there. Some of us will nerd out about Star Wars with you a little deeper than others, but we'd all love to talk to you about some Angular code. And so to the listener, thank you for joining us today, and we'll catch you next time.
Bye.
Hey, this is Preston Lamb, one of the NG Champions writers. In our daily battle to crush out code, we run into problems, and sometimes those problems aren't easily solved. NGConf broadcasts articles and tutorials from NG Champions, like myself, that help make other developers' lives just a little bit easier. To access these articles, visit medium.com/NGConf.
Thank you for listening to the Angular Plus Show, an NGConf podcast. We would like to thank the NGConf organizers, Joe Eames and Aaron Frost, our producer, Brianne Smithia, our sponsors, and our podcast editor and audio engineer, Patrick Hayes. You can hire him and find him everywhere on social media at Pat John Hayes. This podcast was mixed and mastered by Spoonful of Media. You can find out more information about their work and the services that they offer by going to spoonfulofmedia.com.